This is Busted Pencils, fully leaded education talk. Here are your hosts, Dr. Tim Slecker and Dr. Johnny Lupinacci, educated educators talking education.
Welcome, Thursday night, Busted Pencils, fully leaded education talk. Educated educators talking education, 855-752-4842 is the number if you want to jump in and give us a call. Yeah, man, Johnny, getting a lot of feedback for last night for us taking on the billionaires, pointing out that the possibility that there are Republicans who like public schools and therefore who can stand up for democracy, you know, pointing it out. And as we keep saying, core democratic values, doesn't matter what team you want to play for, as long as you support core democratic values and support public schools. Hey, we're going to give you a shout out. So, Johnny, great feedback from the show last night. Tonight.
Awesome. That's great to hear.
Great guest tonight. And you know, I want to jump right into this here. He is a writer and educator who challenges the status quo in academia. In his latest blog post, When ChatGPT Comes for Scholarship, John delves into the controversial use of generative AI in academic research. Or we can have it this way. Introducing John Warner, the rebel with a cause in academia, in his latest post, When ChatGPT Comes for Scholarship, John takes a swing at the use of generative AI in research, calling out the mindless production of academic papers. I don't know, John Warner, which intro did you like better, man? Because whichever one you pick, you're going to make somebody happy and somebody sad.
I would say, I'm going to be honest, I think I prefer the second one in the spirit of the show, having been here before.
There it is.
Oh, yeah. So,
he is John Warner. And again, Why They Can't Write Killing the Five-Paragraph Essay. You can see a lot of his blog posts in Inside Higher Education. John, welcome back to Busted Pencils.
Oh, always a great pleasure to be here with you guys.
Okay, so John, we're going to take on AI, and we were having a little fun before the show, me, you, and Johnny dealing with this, you know, kind of, whoa, what's happening? But John, I start those intros. I had ChatGPT-4 write them for me, and you actually preferred one over the other. So was the number two ChatGPT much more in tune with the real John Warner?
It's more in tune with like the spirit of the show, right? Of like a sort of having fun, putting an attitude into discussions about subjects that can sometimes seem a little dry out to outside people, and being a little bit passionate. So yeah, the second one would be my personal preference.
So the first one would be more like the academic research, which is kind of what we're talking about here. It's When ChatGPT Comes for Scholarship, Inside Higher Education. Take a look at it. I just want to quote from this, John, a couple of times. The inevitable has now happened, and what is clearly unedited generative AI content is finding its way into, apparently, peer-reviewed publications. It's possible that this practice is already disturbingly widespread. Peer-reviewed journal articles. John, wait a minute. That's the academic, absolute, you know, kind of biblical writing. Like, that's sacred writing. You mean to tell me that you think ChatGPT is being used by some of these academics?
Yeah, no, we know it is because the indicator, right, that sort of triggered this is people did a search on the sort of boilerplate language that ChatGPT uses when it can't really answer the question, where it will say something like, as a large language model, I cannot blah, blah, blah. And so people did search for the string of text, and hundreds and thousands of articles came up from published databases. So we know not only is ChatGPT being used, but it's literally unedited in the way we would accuse a student of cheating if they put this kind of thing in their work. And it's not that ChatGPT couldn't be useful in academic publishing. I just was talking to a physician and medical professor out in California yesterday, and he talked about how GPT is a tool to sort of summarize data tables, right? Mm. Something that is purely descriptive,
right?
That has to happen in the stuff he publishes, could be fantastic and a huge time saving, and is no different than what would happen if a human did it in the same way, like a calculator calculates sums or multiplies, divides the same way a human does. But there are parts of, at least I hope we believe this, there are parts of academic writing that we believe should be the product of human thought, right? That if we outsource all of that to something that cannot think, cannot feel, cannot read, and cannot reason, then what's the point? Why keep doing this stuff?
Man, I don't know. I know some full professors that if it sounds like you just described them there the way you cannot. No, Johnny Lupinacci, come on, man. You're out there, 70 plus publications. Johnny,
hey,
what do you got, man?
Oh, man, I'm just soaking this up because, Tim, you know, you and I have gone back and forth and we've sort of taken sides on this, even though I'll be honest, I'm on the fence because I originally didn't know a whole lot about AI. And I was sort of like, oh, this is just garbage. It's just a search machine. And then, you know, we started talking about how it came up and how many of our undergrads and grad students were using it and saying, hey, here are some real practical ways we're using it. It's a great way to get unstuck in our writing. You know, I'm asking like for some suggestions on some readings. They're also finding some ways it was wrong. You know, and I was tinkering around with some early versions. And, you know, I was just like, this is just garbage. This is garbage stuff here. You know, maybe it'll help us speed some meaningless content. And to me, it felt like, you know what it's going to do? It's going to really make the tool of writing more creative, more meaningful. It's going to make the professions of journalism, right, and being an author more valued, because I know so many young people out there who love writing, right? Who got the idea to go into the profession, and then they ended up writing meaningless content, and they felt like there really wasn't much use of their skill. Well, I think that's going to eliminate that, because now AI will do the meaningless production of words, and really, and we'll really have to lean on like what John said, human production, like the human idea. And then, Tim, you started taking me down this whole like Alice in Wonderland trip. I'm talking about like I'm no hallucinogenics necessary, right, where you've trained your computer to know kind of the things you're writing about. And it sounds like you, it's writing similar to you. I'm still skeptical. And I'm saying, yeah, Tim, are you sure you're not just writing this and sending me something you've written? But, you know, it did pique my interest, because as someone who writes every day, I thought for sure, hey, it would be really great. Sure, if you could speed up some of my work, maybe summarize some of the things I'm a little long-winded about. You see, I'm a long-winded dude. I'm still talking like now, on my one little spot. Yeah. So what I'm saying, so we've gone back and forth. Tim's pro AI. I'm still against it, but I could be sold on it. And, you know, and John's a writing, you know, you talk about teaching writing. You talk about the importance of writing, the craft and the art of it. So, I mean, you're here as an expert, but also listeners and myself, selfishly, we want you to settle the beef.
Well, so this technology, right? And when we're talking about AI, we're talking about, in this moment, when we're talking about writing, we're talking about a very specific category of AI, generative AI, or the large language model, right? So it's important to put boundaries around what these things are. And it is a potentially useful tool for the production of syntax. But what I would like to suggest is there's a difference between writing and the production of syntax. Even though the ultimate byproduct of writing is a string of syntax, right? Words that we can read and take in. Reality is that the process of writing, that is when we write, writing is when humans write, writing is thinking. We are both trying to capture an idea or a feeling or an experience. And while we're doing that, because we're in the midst of it, we're also seeing that idea or feeling or experience be altered by the process of writing. So what winds up on the page is likely somewhat different than whatever our initial intention was. And that is an important process and a uniquely human process. And it's also a fantastic process for learning, right? Like writing about something is a great way to learn about something. ChatGPT, Claude Opus, all the other large language models don't do anything like that. They are syntax retrieving machines, matching patterns based on a truly unfathomable amount of other syntax that it's digested, right? It is a mechanical marvel, but it is a fundamentally mechanical process. And it is not what humans do when we write. So if the human process does not matter in any way, sure, outsource it. But I would ask, what are the consequences of that? Even something where you're like, oh, I got to get this out of the way, or it's easier to do it this way. You may be denying yourself an experience that will reveal something to you that you otherwise might not have recognized, right? Mm-hmm. Or you may have a sort of internal experience, something like something we've all done, which is write recommendations for students, right? Often time-consuming, sometimes burdensome process. It might be tempting to try to outsource this kind of thing to a GPT. But the reality is, when I write a recommendation for a student, I am re-experiencing that course with that student or that relationship I had with that student, as well as the teacher I was at the time I taught that student. And this process of reflection that allows me to write those recommendations has a profound effect on how I look at my own work. And really, that's the sort of thing that led me to change a lot of how I taught writing, because a student would ask me for a recommendation. I would like look up what they wrote for me. I would look at my comments for them. I would think about them and be like, man, that didn't work as well as I thought it should. Maybe I should do this differently, right? Ultimately, our lives are lived through experience. And if we deny ourselves experiences around writing just to have a product more quickly and more efficiently, we may be losing something essential. Now, it doesn't mean never do it. It doesn't mean it has no use, but I'm a skeptic as to where this stuff comes into play, particularly in teaching and learning contexts.
He's a skeptic, our guest, John Warner from Inside Higher Education. Oh, man. And we're talking about his newest piece in Inside Higher Education, When ChatGPT Comes for Scholarship. It's Busted Pencils, Fully Leaded Education Talk. The number is 855-752-4842. Johnny wants this argument settled between the two of us. I don't know if we'll get there, but we're going to come
he
back.
He settled it. I'm the champ.
All right.
The champ.
More.
Seconds.
We crawl. Yeah. Well, you don't have to crawl on your knees for us, but it's Busted Pencils, Fully Leaded Education Talk. Educated educators talking education. That's what we do every night of the week, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. Yeah, Busted Pencils. It's 855-752-4842. Our guest is John Warner. He is the author of Why They Can't Write, Killing the Five-Paragraph Essay. He's also a blogger for Inside Higher Education. His latest piece, When ChatGPT Comes for Scholarship, Let's Do Less So That It Matters More. Talking about the drawbacks, and on this one too, very specifically, let's just explain this too when we talk about academic writing and academic research, what that means for our listeners. So all of the, you know, so Johnny and I have another life as professors in higher education. And one of the ways that you get to stay working as a professor is by writing academic research. Or as my son would say, that really boring stuff, Dad, that you write all the time, you know, that no one wants to read. Now, I didn't really have much of an argument against him saying, yeah, Luke, I mean, academic writing isn't sexy. It isn't necessarily fun. It has to be done, though. It is a currency. If you're a professor in a higher ed institution, it's a currency that lets you keep your job in some places. And so it's really important. And depending on where you're at, the amount of academic writing that you produce as a professor has a really profound effect on whether you will stay there. So, John, I see this piece as kind of like pushing up against that and saying, wait a minute, Tim, you already know your son already thought your stuff was really not that great anyway. And now if it's not that great and we could churn it out really quickly, would this be a temptation then for people to say, you know what, I just got to get this crap out there and published. I might as well use ChatGPT. Is that where you're coming from?
Yeah, I mean, currency is the exact right word, because what we're in is a system where the creation of academic writing and publishing in academic circles, which is supposed to have an underlying purpose of building the collective store of knowledge, right? This is why we ask professors to publish, because you have very specific expertise, and we give you, as part of your job, your enumerated duties, we say you should take some of your time to do this work, right? Because we believe, at least in theory, that we value this stuff, because we need to generate new knowledge and then share that. But what happens, this is an example of Campbell's law. I think we've talked about this in previous episodes. But Campbell's law, right, where essentially the measure becomes the goal. And so if we decide the proxy for a good scholar is the number of things they've published, the only thing that matters is the number of things they published, the process that leads to the publishing of those things becomes largely irrelevant. And so we have this really overproduction of scholarship in a lot of cases. And even they've charted this in different disciplines, but my field's English and the humanities, but the generation prior to mine, I turned 54 next week, but my professors to get a job, like as a creative writer, would have published a couple of stories in, a reputable journal. By the time I finished graduate school in the 1990s, you would need to get a job as a tenure track professor. You would need to have published a full book, right? With the Commercial University Press. That is now even more extreme, right? Like my former employer had an opening a couple of years ago, and they're like, one book mandatory, more than one suggested. If you've written a screenplay too, that would be nice, right? It's the sort of, it's this escalation because we only know how to count rather than evaluate, rather than hold to the principles that this stuff is supposed to represent, which is the building of knowledge. And so my feeling, and I write about this in the blog post, is this is ChatGPT is an opportunity to re-examine the values we attach to this work. It's the same of how we teach writing. It's the same of college admissions. It's all these things that now are under threat because we have this magic machine that can churn out a simulation of this work. Why continue to do that if ChatGPT is doing it? It's a simulation. If a simulation passes muster, then we should rethink what we're doing, because we are humans and we're not here to just engage in a simulation.
I wonder, though, I see you're hitting on that, though, and this is kind of the rub, and we'll let Johnny jump in here, is that, you know, does the requirement, let's put it out there, the accountability system that says if you don't produce numbers, you will not get to stay because it is the currency. And so the reality here is that, you know, for the most part, I need to get this done so I can actually continue to do good work and produce good knowledge. So I'm going to use ChatGPT over here to meet the threshold. And while ChatGPT is helping me meet the threshold, I'm going to do really great knowledge creating writing. Johnny Lupinacci.
I don't know, Tim. I've struggled with this one quite a bit because I can't imagine ChatGPT helping me do meaningful writing. I still am. That's why I said I'm on the fence. You're showing me some cool tools, and I'm like, maybe I could learn, because I'm remembering being a kid in a classroom where we didn't quite have graphing calculators and all the cool tools. And then we had mathematical softwares and all kinds of cool things really helped speed up how we did mathematics. And as a mathematician and a math teacher, you know, I fought that for a while. And I thought, this is actually a great tool. There's a way to bring the tool to the craft, to the discipline. So I'm open-minded, Tim, about this. But as someone, you know, who half of my work week is writing, right? And so I'm thinking about, you know, that would it help make my time more efficient? I'm on the fence about right now. I'm a hard no. I'm like, man, I can't imagine. It seems like it makes me have to do more work because of the way I'm thinking, I'm writing. The writing is helping me think, and it's planning out what I'm doing. It's a process.
Johnny is exactly right. He's using writing as thinking. He doesn't know what he wants to say until he starts saying it, right? So you could give a prompt to a large language model, and it'll generate something. Right. Mm-hmm. And you might decide that's good enough, but it's not the same thing. It's just a string of syntax that is not ultimately the shape of the idea that would have come out if Johnny went through his process of writing. Right. If all that matters is the product and that string of syntax, then it's absolutely more efficient. And if that's where society is going, like, it doesn't matter. Just let ChatGPT churn it out. Then, you know, God bless. Let students have ChatGPT do all their work. Let's have ChatGPT grade everything, and we'll go sit on our floating chaise lounges like the characters in WALL-E, right? Drinking soda and watching stuff on TikTok. I mean, these are the choices. We have a choice over what matters. And ChatGPT is sort of forcing this conversation to happen more quickly than we would like, and causing a lot of panic, but it's not an impossible thing. And really what it's revealing for me is that a lot of this stuff was already going on before ChatGPT. It's just a matter of it now being exposed.
It's Busted Pencils, fully leaded education talk. Our guest, John Warner. Yeah, ChatGPT, is that real writing or not? Johnny Lupinacci's a skeptic. John Warner's helping us out. When we get back, though, I'm going to talk a little bit about going, however, you made a great point, John, though, can it do some things well? More when we get back. Her eyes were, and her scars are how she got them. Has the if you're listening, hopefully you're not getting any scars from us. It's Busted Pencils, fully leaded education talk, educated educators talking education. The number 855-752-4842. We are absolutely digging in. ChatGPT writing, academic writing. Our guest, John Warner, been on the show before, writes for Inside Higher Education. His book, Why They Can't Write, Killing the Five Paragraph Essay. Check that out. Got a text from Jameson in Pennsylvania. Text. Yeah, right there. I love ChatGPT, but I don't use it to copy and paste. When I get blocked with ideas, solutions, or whatever, I utilize it to see if it has any ideas I'm missing that are right there but escaping me. John Warner. So is that a tool usage there, or is that cheating?
It is. I mean, there are areas where like, are you guys ever like watch TV and you see a actor on a show and you're like, I know that person from somewhere, right?
Yeah.
Where are they from, right? And you go to like IMDb and you look it up.
Yeah.
And it's like, I know there's some information that I need quickly, and I would get it eventually if I sat here and thought about it, but it doesn't really make sense to sit here and think about it, so let's do it. That sort of thing I think is useful, but one of the cautions I always have with this stuff is, because of the way the user interface on this technology was designed, it gives the illusion of thought, right?
Right.
That ChatGPT or Claude Opus or whatever these are actually considering this issue in the same way you are, and it is not. It is really just stringing syntax together. And so you could give it the same prompt a bunch of times, and it will come up with new text every time. Mm. And that is both a strength and a weakness of this technology. So to the extent that it's like, oh, I'm a little bit hung up on something and I can't bust past it, but I could, it's something I might Google, or something I might like turn to my buddy who's sitting next to me like, hey, what's that guy's name? Because it's driving me crazy. That's a good use. But the again, outsourcing the important human part of the experience of writing, that's where the danger lies. And unfortunately, we haven't done enough thinking around those things, particularly in education, to really have those boundaries and cautions up yet in a lot of cases.
Yeah, there it is. Busted Pencils, fully led at Education Talk. We got a caller, Joanne. Joanne from Madison. Dr. Joanne, how are you, our friend?
Great discussion. I just have a negative point, a little bit of a downer, and then a positive point. Very quickly, the negative point relates to the biases, because we're training these little machines, the ChatGPTs, with material that's biased, because, for example, Wikipedia is biased toward male authors, male material, as opposed to female, and you can work out the rest. I mean, I don't need to go through all the iterations there. But I'm also concerned about and excited to about the new genres, the new ways of producing material that these generative AI machines are going to allow us to do, because we've got all of these ideas that we could be sharing, but sometimes we're bogged down in the trivia. There's a wonderful song, putting it together bit by bit, you know, that you know, art takes all the details and all that. Well, what if we could get rid of some of those details in writing? You know, that the third draft or whatever, that, hey, we'll give it to our AI machine to clean up, that we won't have to do some of the more mundane aspects of writing, and then we'll be free to do more combinations, more riffing, more the kinds of jazz that we're allowed to do when we are freed. So great conversation, I'm all ears.
Thank you, Joanne. Go ahead, John.
Yeah. So, Dr. Joanne brings up a couple of great points. One is the bias of these things, right? They are trained on the world as it is. Often in the past, right, they're not up to the moment. And any bias that's sort of ingrained in that world is only reflected in the AI. And one of the real dangers we have is an increasing amount of AI material, AI-generated material, is going into the web that the AI then ingests, and then it reinforces these biases over time. And it actually can also degrade the models. The other thing she raises that I think is a really important framework anytime we're talking about this technology is, rather than thinking about it as artificial intelligence, which is really a bit of a marketing term, think of it as automation. It is really a tool of automation. So where there is something that can be automated without the loss of meaning in terms of the human experience or the outcome, I think it's great. Like, I just turned in my book manuscript. If there's not yet a reliable automation for like formatting all of my sources in Chicago style, that would be fantastic, yeah. Right? Because that is a purely, it's like a calculator, right? A calculator does mechanical operations the same way people would, only faster. Writing as people do it is not the same as syntax generation from a large language model. So these analogies sometimes don't hold. So where it's an effective tool of automation, absolutely. It stands the chance to free us up to do spend our time on more worthwhile things. The danger is if we automate something that shouldn't be automated, right? And the reports I hear, particularly from like K-12 schools, is that students being uninspired by what they're being asked to do, particularly around writing, seeing this tool as a way to just get this thing out of the way, the same way like me in math class, when the textbooks were the odd numbered questions, the answers to those would be in the back of the book. And that was our homework. I would just copy down the answers from the back of the book, right? Because I didn't want to do that math homework. If we set up that dynamic and we say, and students are not given a good reason to use the stuff in interesting ways, then we're going to get the least interesting ways, and they're going to miss out on really important learning experiences.
I want to ask this question, John, because Joanne made me think of this, and Joanne, we love when she nasty calls. In fact, Joanne, we were talking about you in the break, how particularly the last point that she was saying about, you know, the, does this allow us a new form, a new genre, you know, comparing it to jazz. But it made me think about this in one way, too, is that so when she's talking about, you know, the third edit, right, the third read through, and I'm going to frame this, you know, some of us can't afford an editor. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so on my third version, if I want to pop it, you know, and I create this really awesome prompt, I tell Chad it's going to be my own personal editor. I teach it how I want it to look for it. And now I take my third draft and I say, look, ChatGPT editor, I need your help because I can't afford a real editor.
Now,
what's going on?
Yeah, if the ideas are in place, right? If it's like this says what I want it to say, but there's some gap between the fine grain specifics of how it's going versus what would be most effective, I think that's reasonable. But the again, my other caution is that when humans read, we're reading inside a rhetorical situation,
right?
Where we are an audience and of message audience purpose, right? The large language model does not evaluate your prose that way. It's just a right. pattern, right? So to yep. the extent that you want your writing to fit to a pattern that it's capable of reproducing, God bless. But you invoke jazz. That ain't jazz, right?
Yeah.
That's nothing like it. But there is a skill here, right? I've got this friend. His name's Andrew Duvall. He runs this company called Write Like, and he has this program Frankenstories, and it's like a writing game for like fourth graders on. And he the game is where you're given a prompt and an image, and the prompt is something like, write like this, these characters are enemies, and the image might be like a basket of kittens. And so he needs a lot of images. He needs an almost unlimited number of images, and he uses DALL-E, generative AI, and Midjourney to do this. And I've watched him do it to get like the exact images he wants. And what he's doing is like a creative director at an ad agency,
yes.
coaching an artist. And he speaks to it that way. So his skill isn't prompting an AI. His skill is understanding how art direction works, right? Something
yeah, he did cool.
In his previous job. So when we think about the skills, like a new genre, like prompting or something, it's the skills of thinking and understanding context and knowing what kind of outcome we're trying to coach out of this automation that is most important, rather than how do you make the best prompt? Because it's a lot of trial and error, and even the identical prompt to different models won't deliver the same thing, to the same model won't deliver the same thing. 6 months from now or a year from now, when OpenAI releases GPT 5.0, our heads might explode and be like, none of this stuff we thought works anymore. So it's not really a technology that you can master, right? Mm. It's a kind, and even the people who developed it don't even know how this stuff works still. they're mystified by things like the hallucinations, because they right. don't really, they kind of made a machine that even surpasses their own expectations for how well it can churn out the syntax. So again, in teaching context, it's kind of like we should teach students all the stuff we've always thought was important. Mm-hmm. Thinking, reasoning, creativity, yep. Curiosity, all of those things will serve them well if they're using this tool the same way it would serve them well if they're not using this tool. And the idea that we have to like orient all their work around it is no smarter than all the other education technology fads that have come and gone and did not change education and did not revolutionize how we learn or any of this stuff. Throwing a kid in a AI tutor bot Conmigo universe is not going to help them learn the stuff that they ultimately need to learn to make best use of this technology. Using the technology more in that way, or interfacing with it constantly, is not ultimately a way to use it effectively.
Johnny, jump in there real quick, and then we're going to give.
Well,
John,
I mean,
because he's got a book coming out. We want to let him pitch.
Yeah, I just love this conversation, because you know, both our caller Joanna and then John lays it out there. There's a tool here. There's a new tool out there, you know, for learners, but for writers, for editors. And there may be some genre changing kinds of things, but the essential skills, the essential process is still there. It's still important to know how to write and to the different ways that you can put writing to use. Mm. Right. And then there may be some tools. I mean, when we get back and break it down, Tim, we'll talk more about, I think there's a nice comparison, and both of us have dabbled a lot in this in the music world. Right. And there's a nice comparison that got brought up about that ain't jazz. Right. And I loved when both John and Joanna were talking about, you know, like there could be some tools like that serve the purpose of that third draft read. Or like John said, I already click a button and my bibliography is created. Right. So there's already a tool I use to create my bibliography because I don't need to think much to do that. It knows what I cited and what I did, and then it just churns that out. So that kind of way that these technologies can value add to the creative process, I'm here for, and it makes me a little less like anti the AI, right? So, but let's hear about John. Let's hear about your work, man, and then we'll get to the break and we'll break it down.
Yeah, John, you got a new book coming out.
Well,
yeah,
it's not coming out. Fire. It's probably not till early 2025, but I have turned it in. It's called More Than Words, How to Think About AI Writing in the Age of AI. And it deals with all these things we've been talking about and more about how do we use this thing as a tool? How do we retain our humanity? How do we prevent education spaces from being overwhelmed by a kind of, purely digital interface, right? With like an AI chatbot as your teacher and this kind of stuff. And I have as many questions as answers in the book, but what I hope is that they are the interesting questions that if we get together collectively to talk about, we'll make some real progress and treat this as a public problem rather than technology that's just going to be forced down our throats by these tech goliaths.
That's John Warner. Check him out on Inside Higher Education, the book, Why They Can't Write, Killing the Five-Paragraph Essay. John, thanks so much for busting pencils with us.
My pleasure. Anytime, guys.
All right, John. When we get back, Johnny and Tim, break it down.
Returning.
There it is.
Yes. There it is.
Busted pencils. Man. Yeah, man. Heavy. Man. Fully leaded education talk. Educated educators talking education. Yeah, it's Thursday awesome. Night. You know, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. Busted pencils. Yeah, we are busting them. The number's 855-752-4842. Johnny, we just had John Warner, our friend. He's been on the show multiple times talking about artificial intelligence. Okay, did he settle the discussion between the two of us? Who's the winner here, Johnny Lupinacci or Tim Slecker? Hey, actually, call in. Tell us who you think's winning. 855-752-4842. I'm not ready to drop and relinquish and go, beat me up.
Yeah, I don't know. I think it's at a draw right now. I think we're kind of converging in the middle on this. If I have to be a judge of my own competition here, and you know, Tim, I like to play to win, but I have to be honest about this here. It's like, you know, I am open to this, in a lot of ways, and it resonates to you know, we've been around on this planet a little bit for a few rotations, yeah. You know, and it reminds me, Tim, of like when photography went digital, right? Mm. And then all of this kind of shift. And now so many photographers are doing both digital and, I don't know, mm-hmm. what we call it, analog, right? They're developing film. The art doesn't go away. But the tools and the things that, like the essence of the craft is still necessary to be good at both. But there's some skills that are different within it. And I remember, like, we talked a little bit about on the breaks music, right? And this is huge. Like, you could be in a studio recording, you could be making hip hop, you could be doing all kinds of mixed music, electronic music. There's all kinds of ways that music is shifting and changing and utilizing different technologies. And when that came on the scene, you know, we were like, that's not a guitar, and that's not a set of drums. That's not a three-piece band. That's not right. real music. And it absolutely, in every way, when done well, is real music. Just like you can kind of strum a couple of chords and call it a song, and it might not be great music, right? You can piece together pieces of samples and electronic music, and it's not going to be that great. But there are skilled musicians that can use those tools in really innovative and exciting ways. And I think that's coming with AI and writing. I think there's going to be a lot of ways that not only our workplace day-to-day operations are made more meaningful. I'll come back to that. We're always going to need people, but their jobs are going to be made more meaningful. And I'll give you an example right from our show. And there I don't think producer Anya is going to mind me saying this because she's doing a wonderful job producing us. But the three of us are spread thin sometimes. We're busy. We're doing a lot of work. And one thing we can do is we can give AI the transcript of our show and say, create a summary, right? Because Johnny doesn't have the time. Tim doesn't have the time. Anya doesn't have the time. And boom, it gives Anya a couple of options. And Anya can read over it and be like, that one works. Let me fix this, edit this, boom, set it up. And we have a beautiful summary of our show. Does it make mistakes? Sure. Sometimes it calls Tim Slecker, Tim Slacker, right? And sometimes it makes little mistakes. But in essence, it allows for someone like Anya to do the meaningful parts of her job, right? And same for Tim and I. We can meet after a show and say, that was a great show. We can talk about it while our summaries are turning out, right? And we can evaluate it. I think it's going to put more heart, more creativity, and more personalization, like personal meaning, back into the jobs we're all doing. I do see it doing that, but there are some dangers to it too, Tim. So I'm still going to hold my ground and be like, I'm like John Henry. I'm going to say, I'm still going against, I still want to go head to head with the AI.
I don't want you having a heart attack out there, man. Tim, I don't know. Tim,
statistically, I'm already going to have a heart attack. Okay. So this is just one way we can expedite the process. If I'm going down with that way, then I'm going down fighting
Taking down an AI. Anya, what do you think there? Johnny jumped in there through a little bit. I mean, you know, from a tool standpoint, we're talking about it, you know, the ability to allow us as humans to have more time to do the human stuff. Do you see that?
Well, I just want to step in case anybody in Madison is listening, that I do a lot of human stuff in my summaries. And don't worry about AI there. but yeah, I would agree. I think what John, our guest John, as well as Johnny and Joanne, all these J names we had tonight, except for Tim. What we all come back to is finally getting closer to the idea that this is a tool. It's, you know, a hammer is not the right tool for every job, neither is a power drill. And in some ways, I appreciate what John Warner said, where he goes, I can't afford a power drill, but I've got this hammer. Maybe this hammer isn't going to do the best job of editing my paper, but I'm going to throw it at the hammer anyway. So that's where I keep coming back to. It's an incredible tool. Like you said, the people who make it don't even necessarily understand it. So I am excited and scared to see where it goes. But that's the truth, I think, of a lot of tech today, unfortunately.
Thank you, Anya. And I'll put it out there very clearly, too, when I asked John Warner about the editor, because I think there is something to this, because the access to, you know, a really high, and I know what he's saying, that when I write a prompt for chat, I'm not creating a human editor the way I would get this. But you know what? There's a reality, though, here of saying, like, who can afford a human editor in this point. So I think there's a discussion here about saying, can it do a decent job of, quote, editing your third, fourth, fifth draft? You know, the answer is I've seen it. I believe it. And Johnny, you started off the show by saying, I've sent some stuff to you. And yeah, you were like, dude, man, it sounds like you. It's written well. And it's like, guess what, though? Yeah, I put in a lot of the work. I put in that creative. I put in the thinking. I put in the time. Yep. And then I just like, hey, chat, what do you think? And I know when I say, what do you think? It doesn't think. I get it. Yeah. I get it. There's no thinking going on. But it makes some suggestions. And some of those suggestions, I'm like, hey, I like this. It actually is. And so in that sense, it's kind of working as, you know, maybe a C average editor for me, because I can't afford to buy somebody to be a human to give me that deep editing that I want. So does it help me as we come to access here and we're about writing? I don't know that that's convincing totally the way I just said that, but Johnny, I know you got a little last something there before we break out.
Well, I mean, I think, Tim, this is great. We're going to keep having this discussion. In fact, I'd love for us to keep having John on, you know, from time to time, talk about AI, because there are so many different ways that it's changing the landscape, or it's influencing the landscape, not only of how we write, like we kind of focused on that tonight, but in teaching and learning, right, in K-12 schools, but also in higher ed. My students are utilizing AI all the time in both thoughtful and meaningful ways, but ways I'm not sure where it's going. So let's keep having the conversation. Let's keep doing what we say, busting pencils, right? And let's be back at it tomorrow, right? Summarize the week.
Back tomorrow night.